accession number 19661, reel 3.
Wireless reel 3.
I suppose it is all part of one's training and you don't think about it. Your job is to command the platoon, and commanding the platoon obviously means getting it to work efficiently and professionally. And one got on and did it. And it means showing that you are interested in every individual in that platoon. They are individuals, they've all got their own problems, they've all got families, some are married, even some of the younger ones are married, they've got families at home, and as a platoon commander, you've got to be able to talk to them, you've got to get to know them, and they've got to be convinced that they are part of some little unit which is their home and of which they are a valued part. They mustn't feel that they're outsiders, they're excluded.
What happened after the handover? What happened to you after the handover from the...
We then had a week, which, as I mentioned before, is a bit of a blur, other than it was wet. But the United Nations were in retreat at that stage. The 6th Rock Division had broken, and 27th Brigade were trying to hold them up. And it consisted of going up a hill, mountain, at night, digging in, hoping the Chinese wouldn't come, withdrawing in the morning, down the hill again, and then up another hill. As I say, one didn't have any maps. I remember one horrific night where we started from a quarry, a disused quarry at the bottom of this particular feature, and we set off in single file in the rain up to some positions which, of course, we hadn't been shown on a map because we hadn't any maps, so we trailed off following guides. It rained and it rained, and as you climbed up you took sort of 3 paces forward and slipped back 1 and so on. And eventually this file of men stopped, or it kept stopping in actual fact, and then it would move on again. And I was there with my platoon. And it stopped. And it seemed to stop for a rather long time, so I thought I'd better find out why. So I edged my way up, people in front of me. And I don't know how far I'd gone, not all that far, when I found a man at the head and nothing in front of him. And I said, "Where are the rest?" "Oh," he said, "they disappeared in front." So here was I with part of the battalion behind me, a little bit in front of me, on this path up this hill, with no idea where I was or where I was meant to be going. So anyway, there's only one answer, and that was to start them off again. And so I said, "Right, off we go." And we set off following, obviously, there was a track. Following this track further and further up this hill. And then we got into the clouds, low, wet cloud. And I'd stop and listen. I couldn't see anything. I couldn't hear anything. And eventually we arrived on a fairly flat piece of land, which again fell away in front. And I thought, well, it was midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning by this time. I couldn't hear anything. I couldn't hear a thing of digging or people talking. So I thought, well, there's only one answer, is to stop here. until daylight. So I got the people who were behind me. I think I finished up with about a company's worth of soldiers and a couple of other officers. And we dug ourselves in for the night. And there we stayed, and we hoped that nobody, the Chinese, wouldn't come. Luckily they didn't. And the next morning we found we were in fact only 200 or 300 yards behind battalion headquarters, so we hadn't done too badly. But that was a sort of chaos which perhaps one doesn't realise happens in war. It isn't all nicely defined, and sort of the enemy are there and we're here and so on. And it turned out all right, but we went and rejoined the battalion in the morning, and we all shown where we should be, and we dug our little trenches, and at 12 o'clock the message came, right, we're going back down the hill again, and off we set off down the hill, and we retreated. And this leads really into another little story about this famous brigadier who had addressed us in Hong Kong, because he was, of course, still commanding 28th Brigade at the time. Hadn't actually seen him since we arrived in Korea. But I was with my platoon. We were withdrawing to wherever it was we were going tonight. And the picture I have in my mind is a fairly open valley with some sort of water running down a stream, a small river, running across this valley. And we were on a track, dirt track, and there was a little bridge over the stream. And as we approached the stream, the soldiers were wet and they were tired and they were probably hungry. And like all good jocks, they were chuntering and cursing and so on, cursing everybody and everything. And towards us came a jeep, and this jeep stopped at the bridge, and a large figure got out of it, who I recognised as this brigadier, who I'd previously seen, I think, only in Hong Kong. And he said, "Round me, chaps, all round me." I think it was my company. We were all together. "Gather round me, chaps." So we all gathered round, and the jocks were all getting chuntry. "Who is this?" And he said, words to the effect of, "I've come to say goodbye to you." So the jocks thought, he's going. "Tonight," he said, "go up that hill over there." He said, "The Chinese will come from that hill over there." He said, "And you will hold that hill, and you will fight to the last man and the last bullet, and you will all die. So I thought I had to say goodbye to you before tonight." And all the jocks were saying, so he bid us farewell, got in his jeep, and he drove off. And that is just one little picture which remains in my mind of that. I think it was 5 days, in fact, of this first 5 days of warfare in the Korean theatre. We then went into reserve after that, into brigade reserve, and managed to get ourselves cleaned up and sorted out, and managed to pick up our machine guns and our mortars and things like that. In the withdrawal, we had lost, in fact, all the Argyle's carriers, universal carriers, the track vehicles, because they'd all broken down. They always did, and they'd been abandoned. So we picked up new vehicles, and in fact we never had carriers again after that. We went on to a jeep organisation, and all the machine guns and the mortars were carried in jeeps. But we then reorganised and got ourselves sorted out. And after that, apart from, say, not being particularly well equipped, we managed to get ourselves in some sort of order and follow a reasonable pattern of going into defensive positions, patrolling, and all the things that one does in this sort of situation.
Did that little speech from that brigadier present you with a problem as a platoon commander about having to handle your men afterwards?
No, I don't think so. The jocks thought he was rather a joke. They do. They very quickly see through anything like that, and they have a tremendous sense of humour.
What do you recollect happening next?
Now, this was when we'd be talking April, May at this time. We spent quite a bit of time. The situation stabilised. Luckily, the Gloucesters had fought their battle over to the west of us. The two brigades at this time were totally independent and worked independently under command of American divisions, usually. But the Gloucesters had fought their battle. That advance had been stopped. Cap Yong, which in fact the major battle there had been fought by the Australians, who had a battalion in 27th Brigade, along in 27th Brigade and 28th Brigade. And in fact, we also had a battalion of Canadians, the Princess Patricia's Light Infantry. Cap Yong had more or less halted the Chinese on that side. And the whole front had more or less stabilised. And we went into defensive positions for some time. It's difficult to remember the time scales. But then we did start to really consolidate the position. We did do a small advance to get some features which were perhaps dangerous to us if they're occupied by the Chinese. But it was a fairly static war, and during that time they formed the 1st Commonwealth Division and brought the, in fact, by then, three brigades together in one division, because the Canadians, by this time, had also sent out a full brigade, and in fact, the Canadian battalion had left 28th Brigade and joined the Canadian Brigade. So there was, at this time, three independent brigades, 29 British, 25th Canadian, and 28th Commonwealth, which was two British battalions, one Australian battalion, a New Zealand field regiment of gunners, an Indian field ambulance, and various other odds and ends. The other strange British battalion was in 29 Brigade, and that was a Belgian one, in fact. There was a battalion of Belgians attached to 29 British Brigade. But anyway, they decided to form a Commonwealth Division. Obviously, this idea of one British brigade had been abandoned, and they decided to have the Commonwealth Division. General Castles came out to form the division, and we were all brought together in one part of the front. And not long, and obviously organising all this takes quite a long time. It didn't really affect people at my level, but it did mean that we remained fairly static while it all happened in defensive positions and so on. But obviously there's quite a lot of work going on higher up and behind us, making a coherent whole of the division. And it wasn't long after the division was formed that the first major offensive by the United Nations was planned, and this was Operation Commando by the 1st Commonwealth Division. It was the first major operation by the 1st Commonwealth Division and was a set-piece attack on the Chinese front line. And as I remember, this was October 1951. Commando was a success. Some people would say, in spite of our brigadier, all we knew at the time was that after commando, the brigadier disappeared, and in fact, our colonel was given command of the brigade, so Colonel John became the brigadier, and our second in command took over command of the battalion.
So what are your own memories of Operation Commando?
My own memories were, the battalion had a set piece attack on a fairly nasty feature, very difficult to describe, but the features there weren't particularly high in absolute terms, but they were steep, and they were covered in scrub and trees. Obviously, when they're heavily shelled, you then got a lot of debris from the trees, which made progress difficult. And we had a fairly strongly held Chinese position to attack, and A Company, for once, were the reserve battalion, a reserve company, and the three other companies were the main attacking companies. But C Company, who were in the centre, hit very strong opposition, and the first we knew was when the casualties from C Company started coming back and coming through our positions in reserve. And they failed to take their objective. And we were then told that it was our job. We were to pass through and carry on the C Company attack. I mentioned my company commander, who was still the same man, very brave officer, had been in the Second World War. And I shall always remember that attack for what he did. Or perhaps I'll remember him, and through him I'll remember the attack, because he realised that the company were bound to be affected, having seen the casualties come back through from C Company and knowing that they were then going to have to take over that attack. And he knew that it would require something a little bit extra. So the first thing he did was send for the pipe major. He then led us to the position, and he and the pipe major, he wielding his walking stick, which was his trademark, he and the pipe major led the company, with the pipe major playing the regimental charge, which I think historically is probably the last time that anybody went into action in a Scottish regiment, led by a piper playing the regimental charge. It's a slightly unusual happening. But George picked a ridge line where he had two platoons down on the right, a platoon down on the left, and George silhouetted on the ridge line with the piper leading the company into the attack. And he was unscathed, the pipe major was unscathed, and the company never stopped. There has to be a relationship between those things. And we took that position. We had a few casualties, but not very many, certainly not as many as C Company had had. And we consolidated that position. And there we remained. It wasn't a very nice position. The Chinese didn't like us being there. That attack had bitten in to their main line, and whereas they weren't worried what you had if it wasn't what they regarded as, rather like us, you're prepared to give away anything which isn't essential, but we had bitten into their main line. And they didn't like that, and life from then on was uncomfortable on that particular feature. And it was shortly after that, in November, I can't remember the exact date, We were constantly being attacked, probing attacks, bit of artillery, this sort of thing. And on this particular night in November, we were very heavily attacked by the Chinese, who obviously like to get rid of us. We had defensive fire planned for our position. That is fire which is pre-registered, so that all the artillery have to do is squeeze the trigger. Because if the guns aren't being used for anything else, they are trained on the defensive fire task. So if you call for it, you get an instant reaction. We had this, and when things were getting a bit rough, we called for defensive fire, and down it came. Unfortunately, instead of coming down just in front of us, it came down on top of us. Now, this was nobody's fault. I suppose it's what today is called friendly fire, which is the most stupid title, but never mind. It's a stupid term for something which can do damage out of all proportion. However, it landed on top of us. The reason for this was that the meteorological situation has an effect on where shells land. And they get a report, or in those days got a report, I think about every 6 hours. We were right at the end of the 6 hour period, and as a result, the situation had changed. The rounds all landed short. I was sharing a dugout with the company commander at the time. Company headquarters and my platoon headquarters being in the same place. And George said to me, "That sounded as if it landed on top of us, Jock. Would you go out and see if anybody's been hurt?" So I went out to see if anybody had been hurt, which was absolutely fine. We'd asked for what you call scale one defensive fire, which means that every gun fires one round. Apparently what happened next was that the gunners called us on the radio and said, "How was that?" or words to that effect. What they didn't know and what we didn't appreciate at the time was that the scale one had destroyed all our radios. The gunners' immediate reaction was, "They must be in trouble, they're not answering us, so we'll do it again." So when they did it again, I was standing out in the middle of the hill, which wasn't exactly the right place to be. And I didn't actually see, but felt as if I saw one land very close to me, and I then felt as if something had hit me. Strange sensation, it just feels you've been thumped by a heavyweight boxer. Anyway, I went back to the dugout, and George said, "They're all right." I said, "I think they are, sir, but I'm not." In fact, I was wrong, they weren't. We'd taken about 10 casualties from the first one. And anyway, we organised an evacuation of them, and I, in fact, stayed there till the morning, when I also went off down the hill. And this was the start of a 1 month, 6 weeks holiday for me while I sought medical care back in Japan.
What were your wounds specifically?
I had quite a large amount of British 4.2 mortar embedded in my body. Largely in the shoulder and lung. I appear to have been standing side on to the explosion, and it went in sort of under my arm and down that side and across my back, which was probably lucky, because I've been facing it, it would have probably done rather more damage. As it was, in that sense, it was probably superficial, although some of it was fairly well in. In fact, I'm still carrying a bit of it around on the lung, because it's better there than trying to cut it out.
What kind of medical treatment did you get?
Well, that's interesting in itself, because it was a real United Nations effort. I went down the hill, as I said, where I was taken back on a stretcher jeep belonging to the battalion. I remember I had a dead Chinaman alongside me on the other stretcher. They had two stretchers hanging out of the back of the jeep, and that was a dead Chinaman, and there was me. And they took me back to the Indian Field Ambulance, which was 60th Indian Parachute Field Ambulance, and they wore the red berets of the parachute regiment, or in the case of many of them, they were Sikhs, so they wore red turbans. They were also absolutely immaculate. Everything was starched and blankered and so on. And I remember arriving at this tented field ambulance to be greeted by a large Sikh who obviously didn't have a lot in English and just said, held out a steaming mug of tea and said, "Tea sob," which was an order to drink it. They were a very, very fine unit. All they did was process the wounded. They gave you immediate care and then shipped you back. But they probably saved an awful lot of lives because they were extremely efficient and very much a part of the brigade. From there, you went to a MASH, as in BBC television. Our supporting MASH, in fact, was a Norwegian one, though I didn't go there. I went to an American Army one. A MASH was exactly as it was depicted subsequently on television. It was a tented hospital, tented operation theatres and all the rest of it. Again, efficient as only American units of this sort can be, with all the technology that was available at the time. One was carted into there, still wearing, of course, the uniform that you were wounded in, basically covered in mud and all the rest of it, so you were stripped. The only thing I was worried about keeping was my Glengarry, which I always wore, and I did manage to hang on to that, which was fairly remarkable because it was regarded as a rather high-priced souvenir by the Americans. But I did manage to hang on to that, but the rest of the thing went away and was burnt. All my kit was taken off. You were then whipped into the operating theatre and duly operated on, and whatever they could remove was removed, and you were patched up and so on, and that was that. The next stage was to go back to Seoul to a thing called the Evacuation Hospital, which again was a holding unit. To get there, I went on an Italian hospital train, which was exactly that. It was staffed by the Italian Army Medical Corps. Beautiful train. I don't know where the train came from. Probably brought it with them. But very well looked after. And the trains didn't travel very fast, I discovered on that journey and subsequent ones. I mean, you could probably walk just as fast from wherever it was to Seoul. But that took me to Seoul, and I was taken to the evacuation hospital, which was in an old Korean school.